Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I'm Brad Rose. I'm an artist, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and somebody who thinks about music and sound far more than is healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest to talk about the songs, the music that has meant a lot to them and left its mark. Previous guests include Whitney Johnson, Jason Woodbury, Sarah DeVacci, Claire Rousset, Sarah Hennies, and so many more. This week, I have a legend on. Especially to me, anyway. I mean, he's a legend. It's Alan Licht. I was super excited and kind of nervous for this one just because back in the mid-90s when I was really first learning about, like, the avant-garde and experimental music and stuff and was reading a lot of zines like Yakuza magazine, Woolly Bugger, which was done by Jeff Chilo of Union Pole. But I remember Alan was one of the first quote-unquote experimental guitar players I ever heard. I still have a copy of it was like a 7-inch or a double 7-inch on Union Pole with him and Lauren Connors that I still have a copy somewhere. Anyway, so yeah, like Alan has been a very integral part of my sort of journey, I guess, you know. And so yeah, I was really excited to get him on the show. His latest album, Havens, is incredible. It's kind of unlike any other Alan Licht album that I can think of. I've been listening to it a lot in the recent weeks, especially like as I started preparing for this. I was listening to it a lot, and now I've just kept listening to it because it's so good. And his band Love Child, like classic band, they played a show. They played two shows this year, I guess. One was a sort of surprise show. One just happened a couple weeks ago, and I'm hoping, you know, there's more to come from there. I know there's some reissues and stuff for that too, so I'll put links to all that in the show notes. Anyway, this was an absolute blast. Like, he's a legend. So hope y'all enjoy it. My guest today is a guitarist, a composer, an improviser, a writer, a journalist, so many things. It is Alan Licht. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How's everything going?
You know, so far so good.
Yeah. Hell of a week.
Yeah.
Well, and better news. So your new record, Havens, is out now. One of the things I was thinking about was, so your last record, you did a record called Currents on VDSQ,
right?
About 10 years ago, 9-10 years ago.
It's close to that now.
I know, it's wild.
It was like November 2015, so it's 9 years ago.
Yeah, it's so weird to think that is 2015 was 9 years ago. Yeah. But so there was a description, like in the description for Havens, it talked about the solo acoustic tracks from, like, playing those tracks from Currents live, and the overtones that kind of emerged through the PA, and how that kind of, I'm just curious, like maybe how that experience shaped some of Havens or the direction, like the explorations on there.
Well, I mean, the kind of, to go into a little more detail, all the stuff on Currents I had only ever played in my apartment. I think it's the only record I've done that was like that, where I didn't kind of like play it live over a series of years and then kind of finally record a version of it for an album release, or just had a live recording that I used that was good enough, you know, to release
right
as an album. So that was kind of a new experience where I was, and I was also playing it all kind of unamplified at home. So even recording it in the studio, I was really playing it through an amplifier for the first time, unless it was totally acoustic. And I think only a couple of tracks on there were just like fully acoustic. For the most part, I was using this kind of acoustic electric guitar that was going through an amp, but then it was also going direct, and it was also, I think, being just close mic'd also. Mm-hmm. But it still wasn't like at high volume, so you weren't really going to hear too much overtone activity necessarily. Although there's one, the last track on Currents, was actually done on electric, and that one I kind of was noticing the overtones, and that was something I was trying to bring out in the recording. But anyway, when I was going on tour, I would kind of be going through the PA, like going direct with this acoustic electric guitar. And depending on what the room was like or what the PA was like, a lot of times some of the stuff I was doing, the overtones would really start to be very prominent, and people in the audience would notice it too. Like they would come up to me afterwards and say, like, they were saying, all those overtones were going crazy, like on that one song or something like that. And so I was like, huh, I think that's something I should maybe kind of think about more, and kind of like taking this kind of material to the next level, if that's what I was going to do. And I also got an invitation to play at someone's loft, Ka Baird, actually. And because she was doing a music series for a while. But it had to be like kind of low volume, and it had to be, I think, only 20 minutes. It was like, I think there were four acts on the bill, but also it had to be over by a certain time because right. It was sort of a domestic environment. And I came up with what became Haven sort of specifically for that show. It was sort of like, I kind of remember this one setting on one delay pedal that would kind of like, it's almost like creates a false kind of like, almost like the Alvin Lucier, I'm sitting in a room, the kind of false mm-hmm. room resonance, like all the, when the, his voice kind of breaks down after it's been played over and over again in the room. So it kind of like can kind of like dial in this certain frequencies, and it'll sound like this, like you're kind of like accentuating a certain overtone, even though you're really, mm-hmm. It's just kind of an illusion, because it's just a matter of kind of a, you know, kind of a delay yeah. effect, like a, you know, an echo effect. But so I did that. And then like over the years, I kept developing that, and it became, you know, it became this kind of 45 minute piece, but I didn't want to do another album which was like just one long piece. So then I mm-hmm. figured out a way to kind of break it up back into two pieces, which essentially is Havens and then 1970, the Stooges cover that's on the double album too. And I had one track that was kind of left over from the current sessions, and another thing that was just something I'd come up with kind of quickly, but needed to be kind of multi-tracked, and that was Five Chords and a Sword. So that was originally going to be the album. And then because of the pandemic, the release got delayed, and then I came up with two other pieces, which are kind of in the middle of the album, the two long pieces. One is called Nonchalant, and the other one is Frank Sinatra Drive. And I basically asked Steve Lowenthal at PDSQ if we could make it a double album, because I had these two new pieces, and I sent him demos of both of those, and they said okay. So that's how it became a double album.
That's awesome. One other thing, I'm wondering if you can explain sort of the idea or the concept, like this phantom harmonics. Like, I've been thinking about that phrase for weeks. And I'm just, I don't know, I'm curious. I'd love to hear a little more about the idea, or like your thoughts on it.
You mean in relation to what I just said about using that yeah. delay pedal? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, some of it is overtones too, but what I can do with that is I can actually kind of get it into a very specific frequency that, and you can hear it on Havens. So it's just kind of like, it sounds like this very sustained tone, and it's just from, but it changes depending, like if I change chords. So it's doesn't necessarily go all the way through a song, no matter what. It's sort of like, it's probably catching some of the open strings on the guitar. And then if I change that, or especially I think in the lower strings of the guitar, then a different tone will come out.
Right.
Or sometimes it can be like multiple, like little tones.
Is there, what the Stooges cover, which I love, which is, it's really great. Is there something like, what particularly drew you to, like, why that song?
I really liked that song. And it was just that when I kind of stumbled onto that tuning, that particular tuning, I think I was just messing around with it and I played something that reminded me of that song. And then I thought, well, maybe I can come up with a whole arrangement of that song in this tuning. That's what I did. I mean, the first time I played it actually was at the No Fun Festival, which was like 20 years ago in New York. And I played it as like a full band with Chris Corsano playing drums, Matt Hainer playing bass, and Tommy Oshirishi playing alto sax.
Wow.
And it was like a 20-minute version. And it's actually, that's actually a bonus track on the Three Chords and a Sword CD that Family Vineyard put out a couple of years ago, which is all covers. And then sometime after that, I was actually, it was sort of in kind of like the touring season of Currents. I was actually opening for Rangda, which was Chris Corsano and Ben Chasney and Rick Bishop. And I kind of incorporated it into the acoustic set that way, like a different arrangement of it. And that was something else that kind of like developed over the years. And what's on Havens is sort of a slightly shorter version of that. But again, it kind of goes back to this first kind of acoustic arrangement I did when I did that show with Rangda back, that's probably now like 2006 or 7. Or no, 2016 or 17.
Okay.
Not quite
still.
That.
Yeah, still almost a decade.
I mean, Chris remembered it from, you know, playing it with me at No Music Fest. Or no, sorry, No Fun Fest. But he really liked the new arrangement. He said it was like, it kind of had a few things in there that were really kind of surprising. And he really kind of enjoyed hearing.
Well, you're getting ready to go on tour, so by the time this comes out, the tour may have already happened. I have to check the dates. But is there anything in particular you're like looking forward to with like doing like this Havens, this leg out? Because you're going out to the West Coast, right?
Yeah, it'll be starting in San Diego and then going all the way up to Seattle. And the Portland and Seattle, I've never played solo before.
Oh, wow.
In all this time. So those will be like first solo shows there, which I'm looking forward to that for sure. I think, you know, there's now a place to play sort of in Northern California, which Ben Chasney actually tipped me off to, the series is called Miniplex, and I think the venue is Richard's Goat Tavern. And that kind of made it possible for me to kind of get further up the coast just to break up the drive, you know, between San Francisco and Portland.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a couple of house shows that are happening, which I'm really looking forward to. I mean, you know, and also 2220 in LA, which I haven't been to yet, but everyone says great things about it. I'm really looking forward to that.
Awesome. And before we get into it, kind of switching gears a little bit, you also have a Love Child gig coming up this weekend, right?
Yeah, that's right. In Western Massachusetts. It's only the second gig in 30 years.
Yeah, I'm just like, how'd that happen?
Well, after we played at Union Pool in Brooklyn in June, and then Chris Brokaw was at that show, and of course we knew him from way back then to when he was playing drums in Codeine. We played with Codeine a couple of times back then, and we toured with him also, but after Chris had left the band. But anyway, you know, like shortly thereafter the show, he was like, posed a couple of dates with some of his current bands, and the one in Western Massachusetts seemed like the best fit, both in terms of schedule and everything else. So we're doing it.
Yeah. what brought you guys back together? Just,
well, there was the 12XU, the record label, reissued. He's done digital reissues of our proper albums, and then also an Appeal Session, which had never come out before, and then also a double vinyl album that was kind of like a best of or something we kind of put together as a compilation of, you know, the tracks we thought were, you know, kind of best represented us, and some things that were alternate versions and were kind of obscurities and things like that. And so, you know, basically it's to promote that release, or, you know, that series of releases.
Ah, that's awesome.
And Union Pool was really fun, so we're looking forward to doing
it again.
We're doing this. Yeah, and this will be, I think, a little bit more of this one. We're headlining, so I think it'll be maybe a little bit longer. And,
nice.
Yeah.
Well, have fun.
Thanks.
Since we have gone back to the past a bit, I'm gonna transition here, and we'll go back even further and get into the reason we're here. And as always, I'm going to begin with asking about what is the first song that you remember?
You know, I don't really have a clear earliest memory of a song. I thought of two things, and one thing it's not possible to have a recording of, but the thing that is possible to have a recording of is, it was what turns out to be, I think, the closing theme song to a children's show called The Magic Garden, which was like a local New York area show. And it was like these two women, I think one was Paula and the other one was Carol. And, you know, they had some puppet friends, et cetera,
right,
you know, in the Magic Garden. And they always kind of opened and closed the show, I think, with two different songs. And I think it was Paula who played an acoustic guitar. So they're both singing, and Paula is playing the songs on acoustic guitar for the closing credit, for sure. She's playing it the whole way through the song. Mm-hmm. I think the opening credit, there's other instruments, so she may just be kind of miming it. But the closing one, I think it's just guitar and the two voices. So whether or not she's miming, I think it's probably her playing it, because yeah, she looks like she's playing the right chords. And that was, you know, that was the show that was on when I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. I mean, the song I remember playing over and over again, the first one, mm-hmm, I remember of that is one day in first grade, they kind of had this, it was going to be a day that was celebrated kind of like international cultures or things from different countries. And mm-hmm, at one station, there was like a cassette player, and it had a cassette in it that was like a Russian folk song.
Oh, wow.
And I sat down, and I don't know if I had headphones or not. I probably did, but I played it, and then I kept playing it over and over again. And finally, the teacher had to come over and say, like, Alan, you need to like go to a different station here, because you have to let other kids, you know, listen to the song. And I was like, all right, okay. And I have no idea what the song was.
Yeah.
You know, it's completely lost.
That's really, to time. Yeah, wow.
But that's the first memory I have of really like playing something over and over again, unless I had already been playing some of my parents' records over and over again at home. But
right.
I don't remember.
yeah, that Magic Garden, like I looked it up, and it was really catchy.
Yeah. But that's, I think that's really kind of my first memory of seeing someone playing guitar, I think, you know.
Yeah, I think I always think about this, think about what my first memory of seeing someone play an instrument or something. And it was probably, like one of those PBS shows. It's probably like something on Sesame Street or, you know, something like that.
And, yeah.
Well, what is the song that either makes you cry or it makes you kind of get in that, like feel that way, whatever that way is?
Well, this isn't a song that makes me cry, but it's one that I find very touching, and it's Rise and Rule. She was born in Honolulu by Bonnie Prince Billy, which is AKA Will Oldham, who's a good friend. And, you know, I did a book with several years ago where it's like a book length interview. And it's kind of a tribute to his late mother, mm-hmm, who I also knew and met several times. And it's just a song I think is very deeply felt. And there's actually a video for it, which has a lot of her artwork, because she did a lot of collage work and also, mm-hmm, drawing and so on and so forth. And then there's also pictures of her over the year with Will and his two brothers. And I just find that just an incredibly moving song for kind of personal reasons.
Yeah, that one, especially with the, like, the, I'm glad you mentioned the video, because I think it's like, in the song itself, it's really moving and it's really beautiful, but in like conjunction with the imagery and the video and just, yeah, it's really moving is the word that I keep coming up with. There's like a real, like, gravity to it, I guess, but yeah.
I mean, a song that actually makes me tear up is the Rainbow Connection from the, you know, the Muppet movie.
I think.
But, you know, I'd rather that people check out the Bonkers right. Billy song than the Muppets. I think people know the Muppets already.
Yeah, I think I had Cat Barrett on here, and I think they brought up, I think we talked about Rainbow Connection. I can't remember what about, but I feel like the Muppets, music in the Muppets for me, it's like growing up in the 80s was like super formative memories.
Yeah.
Why I am as into music maybe as I am, I don't know. Well, what's the song?
When they had the Muppet Show, though, a lot of times they would have musical guests. I remember seeing Debbie Harry on the Muppet Show and Alice Cooper, and like, you know, they always have like such a great time.
I know. That would be.
And all the music is pretty memorable in the Muppet Show, I think.
For sure. That'd be such a cool, like, I have no desire to ever be on like TV or anything, but being a guest on the Muppets, like a musical guest on the Muppets, seems like one of the, that would be a dream.
Yeah.
What's the song that will put you in a better mood?
The one I chose was Running on Empty by Jackson Browne. I don't know if it's just something I always am glad to hear when I kind of encounter it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot, and it's kind of always been a radio song. To me, that's a song that was kind of a hit on the radio when I first started listening to the radio, or at least pop radio. And it's just like, I mean, I kind of like the droney element of it, I think. Mm-hmm. And I love David Lindley's, you know, kind of lap steel solo, some of the fills, but especially the solo at the end. You know, Jackson Browne isn't someone I'm like a really big fan of, although there's a lot of songs by him that I really like. But that song in particular is just, I don't know if it's, again, it's this, maybe some kind of like, it's nostalgic on some level, just because it's one I knew from, have known for so long, but it,
sure,
for whatever reason, it's just something I always kind of enjoy hearing whenever I hear it. I mean, you know, other, you know, any, kind of anything by Little Richard too. I think any of Little Richard's hits are kind of like, I always kind of like hearing that. You know, that's another thing I thought of.
Yeah, Running on Empty. I was wondering where this was gonna like fit in, because I have like a really soft spot for this song. It kind of, it does the same thing for me. I don't know. I feel like it captures this sort of feeling and like really well. Like, it's just, I don't know. I love that song. I'm pretty indifferent about Jackson Browne. Like you said, I think he's, you know, got some great songs, but I'm just kind of, you know, I don't think about Jackson Browne anytime really. But if this song comes on, I'm gonna sit and listen to it, because it.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, it's a good point about the solo too. It's such an interesting, thing. Like, put a lap steel solo in this song. Like, I don't know. It's a cool idea.
Yeah. I mean, David Lindley was like, he was kind of like a master musician. And I think, you know, I don't know how many people kind of really like realize that that's him, you know, on that song. Mm-hmm. And there's probably other songs out there that, where he makes like a real contribution. But, you know, by all accounts, he really was just like a real kind of treasure to have as a collaborating musician.
Yeah. All right. Well, everybody's favorite question: what is objectively the best song of all time?
the question that doesn't really have an answer, but
right.
This one, I, you know, I really have to think about this. Obviously, I mean, to some extent, I thought, well, it has to be something that has kind of stood the test of time, like for centuries, you know. So then I thought of Bach or Hildegard von Bingen, but then I thought, well, that's just kind of European classical music. And then I thought of ragas, you know, as you know, I mean, ragas have probably sounded to someone who likes that, I think they probably sounded as good now as they did, you know, 3,000 years ago or, right. you know, whenever it was that they first came about. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I kind of recognize that maybe it had to be something a little more modern. And I thought of Ify by Miles Davis, just because that's a song that kind of doesn't exist in a definitive version. Like the one studio version on Big Fun is kind of unlike any of the live versions. And live versions all kind of, you know, can vary in length from like 10 minutes to, I think, close to an hour even. And it's, but then it's mostly like a vehicle for improvisation, even though it does have like a one melody that kind of cues the band to know that that's what they're going into and so on and so forth. So in some ways, I think that's, you could look at that as being the greatest song just because it can't, it's, there's no definitive version. I mean, Dark Star is sort of the same thing by the Grateful Dead, where there's no set version of Dark Star. It could kind of be any length, it could kind of go in any number of different directions. So that's one way of thinking about it. But, you know, what I finally settled on was Looking for the Perfect Beat by Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force. That was like a record I had when it first came out, and I listened to it quite a bit. I only hear it sporadically now, but you know, it's something that kind of, you know, it, you can listen to it and it kind of takes into account, you know, that music can, a song can be, you know, just a voice and a drum and still be a song, but it can also have all the more, you know, complex things that are associated with Western classical music, like polyphony and counterpoint. And also I should say that, like, it's not just a solo voice. It's like call and response vocals. It's group vocals. Mm-hmm. It's also dissonance as opposed to consonants, and not as opposed, but it's actually consonants and dissonance, mm-hmm. both existing in the song, because there's parts that are very dissonant, and then there's parts where it's, you know, just like normal kind of like harmony vocal,
right,
and things like that. And it's something that's kind of like rhythmic based, but it's also got these kind of like, you know, these kind of like melodies and counter melodies. And it has this kind of symphonic form to it, even though it's somewhat compressed because it's like 7 minutes, which is still a bit long, but it really was sort of, I think even at the time people were saying it was like this kind of symphonic rap song, or kind of early rap song. So it seemed like it just kind of ticked off a lot of different boxes, and it was something that was, you know, it was like it seemed like it was derived from kind of ancient sources and, you know, 19th and 20th century, or like, you know, any kind of Western classical tradition. But then it was also on the cutting edge in terms of technology, mm-hmm. because it was like scratching and was, you know, the drum machine and, you know, all the things that were kind of like very much of the moment too. So it really seemed to sort of, you know, exist in several different time dimensions and was just kind of like, you know, the whole idea of looking for the perfect beat could be something that you could find. It seemed to be saying like you could find that in any at any moment in time, or in any musical tradition or whatever it was.
I love this pick. This is such a I was kind of prepping for this and reading about it, and it still kind of strikes me that that this came out in 1982, because there's like elements of it that sound so contemporary. Like, I mean, and just what you're talking about, like how it's like all these, it comes from all these different times. So it feels that way. I mean, it still feels like it, part of it back then came from the future or something. And, right. But yeah, this is great song. And I'd also really love the idea of, like what you were saying before, the idea of, you know, the best, quote unquote, best song being like one where there's not a definitive version. And I think that's like that's like a really interesting concept. And I'm going to have to think about how to make a question involving that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, you know, it's just something I've always kind of wrestled with is like, do you want to make the perfect recording of a song? Because then does that kind of, you know, does that kind of ruin it for playing it live? And at the same time, are there songs that can only be played live, or like the you know, the song, the version of the song that's on the record is sort of like never as good as the way it is live? And we'll actually get to that a little bit later on.
Okay.
So we'll leave it there for now.
Okay. Well, okay. What's a song that you used to love, but you've heard it recently? If you think about it now, it doesn't quite do it for you.
I actually couldn't really come up with a specific song for this. I would say there's lots of records I used to love that I just never listened to, but it's not because it doesn't do it for me. It's just not where my head is at, or I feel like I've kind of absorbed whatever it is on the record, and I don't need to kind of refresh my memory, or nothing kind of makes me think of it in a way that makes me want to put it on. I mean, there's also kind of entire genres of music that like drum and bass was something I used to listen to a fair amount in the late 90s. And I never even think about it, let alone listen to it. I would say that it's almost the opposite, where I think there's a lot of music and a lot of songs I didn't totally appreciate when it first came out, and then I appreciate it much more later, either because I understand things more about production values or just what it kind of was in response to, maybe it's in terms of other music that was out at the same time, you know, just commercially speaking. So, and again, I think that's probably too many songs to mention, but,
right.
So that one, I don't really have an answer for.
Oh, that's fair enough. Yeah. I'm going to be recording in a couple of weeks. I'm doing so that I can have guests back on the show. Like I have, I'm calling it Songs of Our Lives, the remix, and it's all new questions. And one of the ones is like, what is the song that when you first heard it, it was like what you said, didn't really like it, or you didn't connect to it. And now you really love it. Cause I think about that a lot, like music that, you know, when it came out or something, it wasn't the right time for me to hear it or something. And then, I mean, there's some stuff that's, you know, probably some of my favorite music around that when I first heard it, it didn't really connect, but, timing is everything, I guess. I don't know. Okay. Well, what's a song that some people, I don't know, most people hate it, but you don't care. You love it.
That one I chose, Disco Mystic by Lou Reed, which is on the Bells album. And it's kind of his disco song.
Yeah.
And the only lyrics are the title, Disco Mystic.
Yeah.
Like, disco Mystic. And I guess he was a big fan of Bohannon in the 70s. So I think that's kind of him trying to do that kind of thing. And when I interviewed Lou Reed, I think I mentioned that track to him just in passing. it was because I did the Invisible Jukebox with him for The Wire. And I think I played him Bohannon.
Oh, wow.
And he felt that what I played him didn't sound like what he remembered Bohannon sounding like. But he said that it's the sort of thing you really need to hear in a club. It's like, you know, just, I'm not sure that was something he would listen to at home. I thought I remembered reading somewhere that he used to practice guitar along with Bohannon records, like just like playing rhythm guitar, I guess.
Anyway,
that's like, you know, most people kind of write that song off as like filler or like, you know,
right,
kind of a joke. But I actually find it pretty enjoyable to
listen to. I really like it too. There's something, I don't know. There's like this forward like churn of this. Like, I don't know. It's kind of relentless in a really pleasing way to me. So
I like the title also, Disco Mystic. I mean, of all the things that, you know, people would choose to like, you know, like Disco Inferno, like Disco Duck, you know,
right.
Only Lou Reed, I think, would probably think of Disco Mystic.
Yeah. It's a very evocative title. Like thinking about what that could be, but
Also I think it's kind of suggests that like you know, just the whole repetitiveness of disco has some kind of mystical trance sort of dimension to it that you know, it would probably not register with 99%
right.
of the audience, but you know, once in a while there's someone who can kind of latch on to it that way.
I like that. That's something to think about. What do you think is the most romantic song?
The one I chose is The Kiss by Judy Sill. And I don't know if it's the most romantic, but I think it's a really beautiful song about kind of the idea of love and just the idea of kind of communion between two people as, you know, kind of manifested in a kiss. And again, I think that there's this kind of like kind of cosmic dimension to it, which is maybe not romantic per se, but and also the music itself is very much, I think, rooted in Bach and classical music, kind of which I know she was really into, and that's, I think it's fairly overt in that song. But I just, you know, to me, that's in terms of a way of talking about love in a beautiful way and setting it to what's really beautiful music. That's the song I thought of.
Yeah, that's beautiful is the word that keeps coming to mind, because the orchestrations and stuff, and then I love the way that they've like her voice is mixed, like how it's, I love the production of it, because it feels like her voice is sort of floating above everything, and I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. But probably the orchestration makes it a little more romantic sounding. I think when I listened to it again before this, I think I was listening to maybe her playing it, you know, like on a television show. She was just her playing piano and singing, wow. which is nice also. But that's right.
What's a song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
For that, I chose Bollywood by Liz Phair, which is, I guess, on her album Fun Style, and it was her rap song. And it's like, I know when I first heard it, I couldn't really tell if it was kind of self-parody or really what she was trying to say with that song. I mean, it's her kind of turning a song into a lot of her kind of career problems, and like, you know, like trying to get a job scoring TV shows, and she's talking about all this and like her, you know, her management and like her lawyer and her, you know, her like music publishing representative, all this kind of music business stuff, and like, you know, the rhymes are pretty bad, and you know, it's like, you know, she's not a rapper obviously, but I mean, I think it's something she was having fun with at the same time, so, but it just seemed like it was something that was just going to alienate a big part of her audience too, so, and maybe she was conscious of that, and you know, it's like I said, I just didn't really know how to take it, whereas before that I wouldn't have found there to be anything kind of ambiguous about what she was doing. I mean you know, Exile and Godfield was a record I liked a lot, and then I didn't quite pay quite as much attention after that, but it was sort of like, it was just kind of a confusing track.
Yeah.
On several levels.
Yeah. I think that's a good word for it. I often say that I like music that confuses me, and I don't know if I mean it in this way, but it's a song. Because it is so sort of perplexing to me that I find myself thinking about it more than I've thought about, yeah, like anything else she's done in a long time. So I guess in that way, it's kind of a success.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly stood out, at least at the time.
what are your favorite, like, well, first of all, are lyrics like a thing you pay a lot of attention to? Like, are they important to you?
Sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. I think, you know, a lot of what I liked about punk rock was the lyrics, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of, I mean, one song I thought of was Life by Flipper, you know, the line, life is the only thing worth living for. And a lot of the Germs lyrics, I think, are really amazing, even though you can't, they're kind of unintelligible. You have to really look at the lyric sheet to kind of figure out what he's singing. But then sometimes there's songs that I think are kind of let down by the lyrics. Like I really like the music, and then when I actually pay attention to the lyrics, you know, especially in heavy metal, I think like musically, I like a lot of heavy metal, but lyrically, I think a lot of times it just doesn't measure up. But the song I chose was Remake Remodel by Roxy Music, and specifically just the line that the backup vocals are saying, which is CPL953H. I think that's what it is. CPL953H. And that turns out to be the license plate number of a car that's was being driven by a woman that Pine Ferry noticed on his way driving to the studio in his rearview mirror. And I guess he made a note of the license plate number. So I think he was hoping that whoever it was would hear the song and then reach out to him, get back in touch, or not back in touch, just get in touch to begin with. I never knew that until, much later after hearing the song. And I probably couldn't even decipher the lyric at first. And then I think at some point I found out that that's what they're singing and that's what the reference was. So, and the idea of that being kind of like a backup vocal thing in a pop song, I think is kind of a neat idea. He was sort of, Brian Ferry was kind of like someone who was in art school during the whole pop art era. And, the song Virginia Plain, I think especially, is like the lyrics to that are like, and I think probably some of the other lyrics on the first Roxy Music album kind of show that kind of lineage where he's kind of like referencing cigarette brands or, whatever it is. There's a lot of different things that he's sort of like putting into lyrics that are kind of equivalent to, painting a Brillo box or, whatever it is. It's sort of like product, not endorsement but identification anyway.
Right. That's where I had, I didn't know I didn't know that story about those lyrics behind that. That's fantastic. It's like the most convoluted, missed connections ad or something. that's awesome. I love that. What's the last song that you completely fell in love with?
Yeah. So I chose Simulation Swarm by Big Thief. And it was something that it's kind of a long story, but at some point I had to kind of check out a bunch of songs that are from the last, more kind of hit songs or just kind of more kind of commercial songs from the last few years. And someone sent me a bunch of them, and that was one of the ones they sent. And I really like that song, and it's, it's not revolutionary or anything. And it's, it's a really well-made song. And it does remind me of a couple of other songs in parts, but, and I really like the chord progression to it and the melody and her singing, and I don't know. It just really appealed to me. And the lyrics, the lyrics are actually quite interesting. And that's another one with a good video. I don't know if you've seen the video.
Oh, I haven't.
For it. It's sort of like this animation thing, and it's like some animals sitting around a fire playing instruments, and it's mostly kind of static, or they're only moving very slightly, and it's just like a black and white drawing. And then every once in a while, there'll be like this little flurry of activity somewhere, like one of their heads spins around or something, just for 3 seconds, and or there'll be a swarm of something, but again, it's just for a few seconds, and then it's gone.
Well, I'm gonna take a watch that as soon as we get down here. That sounds really cool. Yeah, I really love the main, yeah, that chord production, that main guitar riff on this is so, there's just, yeah, there's something about it that is so pleasing.
And the bass line is really nice. There's like, they're playing like a very high register kind of bass line over it in the verses, and then it's, they kind of switch it up, I think, in the chorus, but the bass line, it really is really good too.
Well, what's a cover song that's better than the original?
This is a song that I didn't even realize was a cover song until fairly recently, and that's "Killing Me Softly" by Berta Flack, which turns out to be a cover song of this. Yeah. It was by, the original performer was Lori Lieberman, and it's okay. Just a very much more just like a folk song, and she co-wrote it, I think, with her producer and I think some other writing partner. And apparently it was on, you know, some album that Roberta Flack heard on an airplane, like just on the airplane, like music channel or something. And she got really into it and listened to it over and over, and just said that, you know, she could see how she could like do her own interpretation of it. And then, you know, I think recorded it probably the next year with like, you know, it's apparently kind of an all-star jazz band backing her up. It's Ron Carter playing bass and Freddie Tate and like all these kind of like first call like jazz players. And it's, you know, it's a very memorable song. And it's in the original version, I would say it's like somewhat forgettable. It's like okay, but it's a little stiff actually. And then, you know, just the Roberta Flack version is just like a total reimagining of it, and just really brings out everything that's great about the song, I think.
I didn't have any idea this was a cover song until I started prepping and then realized, because usually, like, that's one of the questions I can kind of, because I always try to figure out what the answers, what questions are going to go to. And I was like, I don't think any of these are cover songs. And then as I was, I've had this conversation a couple times where, like, I think somebody, like, you know, like definitive answers to this question of, like, somebody picked like All Along the Watchtower or something, which.
That's always the first thing I think of, but I figured somebody else must have said that before.
This may, to me, in my mind now, I think this may be the definitive answer, because her version of this is so, like, stunning. It's just, they're, God, everything about it is, oh, it's amazing. That's so, it blew my mind this week as I was preparing to learn that this, because it's like hard for me to imagine somebody else having done this. So I'm gonna have to, I didn't look up the original, but I'm going to, because I'm curious about it, even though, you know, from your description and stuff, I know it's not gonna be this.
Yeah, but it's really interesting to hear just in relation to what it became, you know, in the hands of Roberta Flack and the producer, I guess.
Yeah. All right, we got two questions left. So the first of the last two is, what is the song that means the most to you? And it's not necessarily because of the song itself. Maybe you associate it with something or someone or an experience or something that was really important to you.
Right. And I picked It's a Wonderful Life by Henry Kaiser, which is kind of a sidelong, the first side of his album of the same name. And it's this very long guitar improvisation, but it has a number of different movements. It's not like kind of one continuous thing. They're like, some stuff is like this kind of like very kind of complicated kind of like time signature thing where things are kind of weaving in and out of themselves. And it's, I think a lot of it is accomplished with multiple delay pedals. And this is from, this recording is from 1984. And there's other, and then some of it is sounds like Terry Riley, and it's much more kind of droney. And I think when I first encountered it, you know, for one thing, it just totally like blew my mind as of what the possibility of solo guitar playing could be, because up until that point, it was either, you know, Eruption by Van Halen or Joe Pass, you know, which is, you know, kind of fingerstyle jazz chord melody. But this was just something completely different. And I kind of encountered, I've told this story a lot, but I kind of encountered Henry in the pages of Guitar Player magazine, because he did this, they had like a column called Essential Listening, where someone, a different guitarist, would pick like records that they want to recommend to people. And Henry's was kind of an amazing one. And I would have skipped over it just because I didn't know who he was. But then I noticed that he had Trout Mask Replica and Live Dead and Miles Davis, Jack Johnson on the list. And I think I had all those records at that point. And you know, in the introduction, it said that Henry's current record was It's a Wonderful Life. So I probably wasn't able to track it down right away, as I was still probably a ways away from kind of knowing how to get it, because it was on his own label, it was on Metalanguage. But I did track it down ultimately, and I was really just blown away by that. And then I went on to, you know, study guitar with Henry at the National Guitar Summer Workshop, and I've stayed in touch with him ever since. I did a CD with him a few years ago called Skip to the Solo, where we're kind of taking turns playing solos over vamps and things like that. It was just something we both, you know, kind of like kind of learned guitar by doing, to playing along with the records. So that's, you know, that was like a mind bending track. And then it led to this, you know, not only this association with Henry, but just my own kind of solo guitar albums, of which there's now like, you know, 8 or 9 of them, I think. So, but that was really like the track that kind of introduced me to that whole idea of really kind of like kind of extended technique in solo guitar playing. And you know, his whole thing is that he's trying to make it sound like a bunch of different people playing at the same time, or like multiple guitars, you know, at the same time. Kind of, and he said it was sort of like inspired by Terry Riley's organ improvisations, where he's doing, you know, kind of like this very like, again, using kind of delays, he's makes it sound like, you know, 3 or 4 keyboardists playing at the same time. And then also Evan Parker's solo saxophone playing, where he's using circular breathing, and it sounds like 3 or 4 different melody lines going simultaneously.
Yeah. This is, I heard this much later, but I still think there's like nothing else that sounds like, yeah, it's such a good record. And just, yeah, that 25 minute. So how many different threads and movements there are. It's an adventure to listen to. I love it. So, all right. What is, at least in this moment of time, or maybe always, what's your favorite song?
Yeah. So I chose You Made Me Realize by My Bloody Valentine, which the first time I heard it was when I saw them live opening for Dinosaur Jr. at, I'm not quite sure if it was what became the Ritz, or it is somewhere in Midtown, but it was, you know, I had no idea. I hadn't even heard My Bloody Valentine before seeing them play. And I was really like loving the set. And then they played the song, and then there was like this 10 minute noise section in the middle, and I was just like, what is going on? Like, you know, it really was like kind of like one of the greatest things I'd ever seen. And then of course I went out and got Loveless. Mm-hmm. And but of course that song isn't on it. It's on an earlier EP. And I saw them again, I think during like New Music Seminar or something like that. And I think maybe that was at the Ritz, or what was then called the Ritz. And that was, they played it again. They played it even longer, but it was almost too loud. It was kind of like, I think it was almost twice as loud as it was.
Oh, wow.
Opening for Dinosaur, maybe because they were headlining, and then they just said, well, you know, maybe there's a dB limit on them when they were opening or something, but it was just like almost too much. But it was still like, you know, kind of an unbelievable experience. And then actually kind of much later, I finally heard the studio version of it, which is okay. It's sort of badly recorded. And of course, like the noise section only lasts for like 30 seconds or something at the most. And I mean, I like it, but just that experience of hearing it live you know, it's sort of made it as my favorite song. I mean, I like the song even without the noise thing. It would be a really good song, but that just is the fact that it just sort of like takes on this completely different identity live, and you kind of, unless, and even a live recording doesn't really capture what it's like to be in the room with it. And of course it's going to be different depending on what the room is. And,
right.
You know, so then going back to what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of like a song that doesn't exist in a definitive version and kind of can't even be contained by a recording to some degree, and also cannot even have like a definitive live version because it sort of changes every time it's played live. I think this is a really great example of that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it's got to be the loudest show I've ever been to. Like you said, it's almost too loud. It almost hurt.
Right.
Maybe at times it did. I think, I don't know. I mean, it's just, they're so loud. I'm trying to think if I've heard them do this live, because I saw them later and I don't know that they played this, but
I think they were, even when they did the kind of reunion shows, I think they were, I didn't see them any of the reunion shows, but I think they were still playing it at least in the beginning of doing that.
Maybe they did. Maybe I just, that whole show was kind of, like I said, it was like physically imposing the loudness. And so I think like that's my biggest takeaway from it, was I felt like I'd been like through a hurricane or something when I walked out, because it was so.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely what made me realize was like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they played it, it was just like, oh my God.
I was having this conversation with somebody about the loudest thing show we'd ever been to. And the funny thing is, they were like saying, yeah, I saw My Bloody Valentine and it was really loud, but Dinosaur Jr. was the loudest thing I've ever seen. So it's interesting that they opened for them. And
I think Screaming Trees was the other band on the bill who were like, and they were loud also, but not to that level. I mean, Marian Amishay was actually the loudest, or seen the loudest, maybe just because of the kind of psychoacoustics of the kind of what she called tertiary ear sounds, where it's sounds like the sound is like actually kind of coming out of your ears instead of, you know, going in. That felt the loudest in almost like a hallucinatory way. Although, you know, in terms of decibel levels, you know, My Bloody Valentine was probably louder. You know,
I don't really know. Well, awesome. Well, this was a lot of fun.
It was
doing this. Havens is out now. Everybody should check it out. And you've got shows coming up next week, which this won't be out by then, but are there any like further down the line shows or anything planned?
Not yet. I think looking at Europe in the fall, but and I would like to do some shows in the Midwest, but that's something I need to look into once I get back from doing this tour.
Awesome. Well, Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, thank you to Alan Lick for taking the time, being so thoughtful with his answers, and just, doing this. Awesome. Link to his playlist of his picks in the show notes, of course. Link to his new album, Havens, which is out now on VDSQ. And then some other stuff, Love Child, and a couple other things there. Of course, thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, appreciate the show, please leave a rating and or review. Helps get it in more people's ears. If you like it even more than just doing that, you can join the Patreon, patreon.com/foxydigitalis. You get these full episodes, the unabridged version, which has a whole special section just for Patreon, and you get them a week early and you get some other stuff too. Little as $3 a month, but hey, if that's not for you, take that money, put it towards picking up a copy of Havens. Until next time, keep on listening to whatever the hell you want.